Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking. I'm Kara Gallo Regan, and with me is my co-host, Jordan Poland Clark.
Hi.
And today we are continuing Adam Sandler Month by talking about The Wedding Singer from 1998 and Punch Drunk Love, which was from that was from 2002. I almost got through this without messing it up.
Almost, it's been 30 seconds. We have a lot more to get through. I have bad news for you.
Oh boy. Well, listeners, if you missed it, we covered Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore in our last episode, so you can go check those out.
And you should, because if you haven't seen Billy Madison since you were small, it's a different movie than you remember, kind of. Like, some yes and some no.
And it's actually pretty good. Which doesn't always happen here. Anyway. So, Jordan, I guess we'll start with... What will we start with?
we should do them in order. So that means we'd start with The Wedding Singer.
Yes.
Which is a very charming movie.
Oh, the charmingest.
It's just, I messaged Kara while I was watching it yesterday, and I was like, wow, the only other movie that I can think of that's this charming is Waitress.
And I added that I find Music and Lyrics, which also stars Drew Barrymore, to be as equally as charming as this one.
Yep, agree that.
Perhaps more. But this and Music and Lyrics are, like, some of my favorite rom-coms. It's just so good.
Yeah, the Wedding Singer is about a wedding singer,
mm-hmm.
played by Adam Sandler, who was once in a rock band and kind of, like, turned to wedding singing so he can make some money, and that's become his primary career. He's not cool anymore. We get the impression that once he was cool, and now he's not. But he's really good at his job.
Mm-hmm.
He has a really good sense for not just entertaining people, but also just a good sense for people and, like, talking to them at the weddings and, like, helping them out and, like, just being, like, a fun guy. And he's super toned down as far as Adam Sandler goes,
yeah.
Which I think is why this movie is so good.
Yeah.
He only yells 2 times
mm-hmm.
in the whole
And it
movie.
Takes, like, a build-up to get there. It's not his immediate reaction.
No, and one of them is legitimately funny.
Yeah.
So, Wedding Singer, he's engaged to a woman who eventually breaks up. Well, she doesn't even break off the engagement. She just doesn't show up at the wedding.
Ooh.
Linda doesn't show up at their wedding. His name is Robbie. And during all this, he meets Julia, played by Drew Barrymore, who is a waitress at the...
Catering waitress.
Where he does weddings. And so they are, like, hanging out. She's also engaged to a guy named Glenn. This is the only movie we've watched where I know everybody's name. But I think they also say each other's names a lot. The dialogue in this is not the way real people talk to each other at all. But it works. It's fine. And Glenn's a dick.
But he's rich.
Oh, and this is in the 80s. We didn't say that. This takes place mm-hmm. in, like,
1985.
Okay. So everyone has terrible hair. And
terrible hair. Are you kidding? I made a note that the hair and makeup in this is so good. Visually, this is such a strong, strong, strong movie, and I love that about it. Oh, it's excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
They really nail it.
Super colorful, like, over the top.
Mm-hmm. But also, like... Well, if I can, for just a moment, I'd like to shine a little spotlight on Mona May, the one and only Mona May, costume designer extraordinaire. Do you know what she also did costumes for, Jordan?
I should know. Clueless?
Yes. Good job. Yeah. And, like, a bunch of other stuff. But obviously, an icon.
You know what? This has the same aesthetic as Clueless, mm-hmm. except this was the 80s and Clueless was the 90s.
Yeah, kind of.
But it's the same.
Yeah, more or less. But, like, the thing that I really was enjoying about it this time when I was watching it earlier today is how like how good all the colors are.
They're really
They're
good.
so good. And like they could have just made the weddings like one wedding after another and like kind of have them all be kind of bland and the same, but they have such like a distinct color, like color change and visual style. All of the parties do have their own like color palette. It's great. I love it.
Yeah.
That alone makes me like just love this movie so much.
Yeah. You can tell that, yeah, it was like you can tell there is a lot of like care and attention put to that. Okay, so.
And also it has an incredible soundtrack.
Yes, and then the music is like nonstop. But hold on, let me do the rest of the plot
Sure.
first, because we're almost there. You can see from the beginning of the movie that obviously Robbie and Julia are going to get together. And then they do.
Because how could
As.
you not fall in love with Drew Barrymore?
I know, well, it's just that part, to me, that's part of what makes this movie so charming is that, like, there really isn't very, or, like, there is conflict because obviously it takes the whole movie to get together, but, like, you know they're going to, like, you know what's going to happen, and it's like it's a nice journey on the
Yeah,
way there.
it
It
is.
really is a nice journey.
And it's funny and it's sweet.
It legitimately was funny, and I also cried.
Oh, I cried so much when I
I
watched this
also
movie.
laugh cried a
Yeah.
bunch of times. Yeah, and the 80s music is like nonstop.
Yeah, I mean, this came out at like the exact perfect time. I was a budding teen goth, which like makes you just predisposed to love 80s music anyway. Yeah, I love this soundtrack so much.
The bit where the singer, not Adam Sandler, the other guy in the band just only sings the one
Oh
song.
yeah. Played by Alexis Arquette, who is wonderful in this. And has a killer trombone solo in one of the songs.
And there's two original songs in it too.
Oh my God. Oh God. The one on the plane, I mean, talk about like sobbing. I
So you
sob
cried.
every time.
Yeah, definitely. And then I cried during the other one was when I laugh cried
Yeah.
because it's so funny the first time he yells the chorus in the other song.
Yeah, and he intros it by saying like, I just want to warn you, I was listening to The Cure a lot when I wrote this, so I'm sorry.
Yeah. And it has so Adam Sandler didn't write this, or he doesn't have a writing credit on it. The other guy does. Tim Herlihy, is that his name? Something like that. He writes most of Adam Sandler's movies with him. So he has the main writing credit on this, and that makes me think that some of like cause some of the like surreal stuff that we saw in Billy Madison is in this also.
Like
Like
what?
when the old lady puts the meatballs in his
Oh, I
hands.
don't. I don't know. That's not surreal to me. That's just
It
like an
was to
Italian grandma.
me.
I don't know.
No, oh, I thought it was like super like weird and surreal,
Yeah.
and she makes him eat them.
I know. I love that woman. Listen, another side note. When I was looking at the IMDb for The Wedding Singer, I like clicked on her profile because she's like one of my favorite parts of this movie. I think she's so wonderful. Her name is Ellen Albertini Dow, and I was reading all about her. She has this incredible life. She like started a mime troupe and was a mime for like 20 years, and she also like taught theater at a college in California for several decades. And then when she retired from doing that, she went to film school and then like started this whole new career at the age of like 67 as a character actress. Is that not amazing? Also, she
Yeah.
went to Cornell before any of that, which is crazy.
In my mind, she was the same person as the grandma from Happy Gilmore,
Oh, I
and immediately I was like,
for
oh,
sure
never
thought
mind, she's
that
not.
was true when we were watching Happy Gilmore, and then I was like, oh no, different lady, but like definitely a kind of a similar vibe.
She's a great rap scene.
Which she rapped herself, by the
Of course
way.
she did.
Oh, but you were talking about how the surreal stuff in the script and that Adam Sandler was not credited as a writer. However, he did do some uncredited work on the script, as did Carrie Fisher and Judd Apatow.
Oh, that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't, no, I can't, I didn't take notes. I'm not good at taking notes when I watch these anymore, because I just watch them, kind
yeah.
of. I can't remember what else I thought was surreal. I mean, the whole, like, thing at the end where Billy Idol is on the plane is kind of surreal and weird.
Yeah.
Billy Idol's in this movie.
Yes, he is. And originally it was going to be David Lee Roth. And
oh,
as much as
sense.
I would have,
there's a lot of Van Halen references.
Loved to see that. I also love Billy Idol in this because he's whatever age he was in 1998.
He's not young.
No,
he's
not at all.
How old he was in the 80s.
Yeah.
This movie would have been right around the time that my dad was working for Billy Idol.
Really?
In real life. Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, I was surprised that I liked this.
I'm not. I think it's
and
just
so
wonderful.
And her name is Julie. Like, the part where she's in the mirror,
mm-hmm.
and she starts saying that her name will be
Julia
Guglia,
yeah.
and she just starts crying.
Because it's the worst.
Oh, my God.
And
Christine Taylor is great in this.
Oh, she is excellent in this.
She is, like, a slut who's owning it. It's, mm-hmm. like, very cool.
Yeah. And this was the first time that I realized that the chef that works for the catering company at the wedding venue where they all work mm-hmm. is Robert Smigel, who is the only person that has been in all four of these movies.
What else was he?
He is, like, Adam Sandler's brother-in-law in Punch Drunk Love. He's married to
yeah.
one of the Seven Sisters.
He's the dentist.
Yeah. And then in Happy Gilmore, he's in that doing something. And then
he's
in
probably
Billy
like
Madison,
some guy
he's also
like
something.
Yelling in the crowd or something.
Yeah, no, he has like actual parts, and I was
really
yeah, I was surprised to see him there. I once sold to him a little remote, a Cars branded. Remember that movie Cars?
Yes.
A Cars branded remote control car that you could control with an iPhone.
Whoa!
And I did not recognize him until I swiped his credit card, and then was like, oh yeah, you're that guy. Oh, also, the guy who plays Adam Sandler's brother in The Wedding Singer, do you recognize him from anything?
He has a brother?
Yeah, the limo driver in The Wedding Singer.
Oh, I thought that was his friend.
Oh.
Is that his brother?
You know,
he's
I have
in,
no idea.
He's in every single Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, but he actually is the guy that plays the caddy in Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
I was surprised to realize that because he looks so different.
Yeah, and he looks different in this than he does in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I had to look it up to make sure that it was him.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, I was just gonna say that they have something that has come up a few times on the show, especially since we've been doing these like male comedian movies, is like. Moments of intimacy, like platonic intimacy between two men that we don't always get to see on screen, and the mm-hmm. two of them have a really tender moment in Robbie's basement apartment in his bed where they talk about laundry detergent.
Yeah they do. That's what, like, this movie is Adam Sandler just being, like, kind of even-keeled and, like, sweet
mm-hmm.
to everyone.
Yeah. It's got a lot of heart.
It's really nice.
Which is interesting, because that's his last name in the movie. It's Robbie Hart. Although I think spelled yeah. differently.
I think that was probably on purpose, though.
Perhaps. So, we mentioned the colors before, but there are, like... The color of, like, his despair in this movie is, like, dark red.
Mm-hmm.
He's in this dark red t-shirt after he gets dumped. There's even this amazing shot where he's, like, at the wedding. He's standing up at the altar. And when his sister is telling him that Linda's not coming, like, it's a close-up of him. And in the, like from the side, like in profile, and in the background are these beautiful blue hydrangea and wisteria, and then the camera kind of like pans around to the front of his face so that the background is like dark red brick. I thought that was pretty brilliant. And then he's in a dark red shirt after that, and like the wedding that he does after that is all dark red. And I thought that was a really interesting choice because like usually somebody would choose like a blue, I think, for that. And I appreciated it. There's this really great scene where he's in his brother's kitchen, which is this like incredible all turquoise kitchen. But they have these dark red blinds, and like one of the windows, the blinds are open, and then the window that Robbie is sitting in front of, they're closed, so you see the red, and he's in the red shirt, and it just, you know, these are the things that make me very happy in movies.
Yeah. Well, they're also the things that make it a well-made movie, whether or not you are a person who, like, notices things like that consciously, like...
Yeah.
You know. I saw The Wedding Singer on Broadway when it was on Broadway.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
I don't remember it at all. I mean, like, a little bit. Cool. Like, it had the same, like, isn't that a cool way to start a story? Is to be like, here's the thing that happened. I don't know anything about it. That's the whole story. It had the same aesthetic, like, as far as, like, colors and, like, the 80s style and everything. Which is much more annoying, I think, on a stage than it is in this movie.
Interesting.
Plus, then they're singing a lot on top of it, which I don't have a ton of patience for.
Yeah.
But Stephen Lynch was in it. Did you like Stephen Lynch?
Who's he?
He was a, I mean, he probably still is a...
oh, he's like a musician comedian. Yeah, I think so. I honestly can't tell you. I don't remember, but probably.
I'm sure a lot of his stuff doesn't hold up because it's too offensive now. It's like stuff that you're like, oh, you can't say that anymore.
Yeah.
I think it was maybe a little too much of that kind of humor, if I'm remembering it correctly. But he was like, you know, he's handsome and has like this gorgeous voice, and then he's just like singing filth.
Yeah.
So he was actually, I think, probably a good fit for this role on Broadway.
Interesting.
So it was fun.
This was actually, so I watched these backwards. I watched Punch Drunk Love first, and then I watched The Wedding Singer, and this was such a joy to watch after Punch Drunk Love, which is so kind of bleak and stark. This one, like, is so lush, and like there's so many flowers in it, and it's so colorful and fun. It was really nice, nice order to watch them in.
Punch Drunk Love is like, I did it in the other order. And then I watched him host Saturday Night Live from last night. And yeah, Punch Drunk Love is just like an exercise in how uncomfortable a film can make you.
Yeah.
I thought. Like, I was like, why am I watching this? Why would anyone keep watching this?
I feel like it's a anti-rom-com. Like, it's taking all of the conventions of romantic comedies and then just kind of, I don't know necessarily doing the opposite, but, like, making the main character as unlikable as humanly possible. And even, like, the music and the lighting is all, like, working against you, whereas...
Oh, definitely everything in this movie worked against the audience.
Yeah. except for the Hawaii segment, yeah, which I think is a little bit more classic. But, yeah, I guess we could talk about Punch Drunk Love now. I had some more things about The Wedding Singer, but we could definitely move on because they're mostly color related.
Oh, okay. I mean, do you want to pick like your top two?
Okay, hang on. Let me zoom through these and see if I can pick something else. Oh, so much good purple eyeshadow. Oh, they have cute like ketchup and mustard cars. They have the same car, but one's yellow and one's red. I don't know if you noticed that. It makes me happy. Oh, there's so many good flowers in this movie. And then the flowers that Glenn brings Julia are so shitty. It's this like elaborate red rose bouquet, but they're wilted and like it's falling apart, and I had never picked up on that before. I thought that was really interesting. Oh, John Lovitz. John Lovitz is in The Wedding Singer, and he's
John Lovitz is in this.
so
Oh,
great.
that's another moment that was very surreal, where he's watching them for too long after he is supposed to have left the room.
He's losing his mind.
That was
And
funny.
I'm reaping all the benefits. He is wearing this incredible costume. It's this black glitter collared button-down shirt, which of course is unbuttoned to show his chest hair. And then on top of that is like this gorgeous green satin brocade rose jacket thing that was really great. And I loved it a lot. Oh, I think this was when I learned what the Mile High Club was when I saw
Okay,
this
yeah.
movie for the first time.
As did the older woman.
Who, I love that lady. She's so good. I guess the last thing that I'll say is that when Robbie and Julia do finally get married, she is carrying a bouquet of daisies, and daisies are Drew Barrymore's favorite flower in real life.
Oh, did you already know that, or you know that now?
I was vaguely aware of that because I think her production company like uses a daisy in the logo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you know who else is in this? The woman who plays Monica's mom on Friends plays Julia's mom.
Oh
And
yeah.
she's like the perfect judgmental mom.
And not even
Christina
just
Pickles, that's her name.
judgmental, just like dismissive, like totally just like yeah, she is very good in this. You know who they almost cast as Glenn?
Hold on, I want to guess. 'Cause, well, the guy that they did cast, he's not really. Do we know him?
I don't think so. I mean, he's been in
Yeah.
things, but he's not like a big name.
Do you know who would have
He's
been
such
good
a
as
perfect
Glenn?
asshole, though. Who?
But if he was a little younger, is the guy who plays Shooter McGavin.
Oh yeah. Yeah, same
Okay,
similar
who?
character type.
I don't know the answer.
Jim Carrey.
Oh no.
Really? Because I read that before I rewatched the movie, and then like watching it with that knowledge, I was like, okay.
I
It would be
mean,
slightly different. It would be very different, obviously, but like I could see him make some choices there.
yeah, like maybe too many choices though. Like,
Yeah.
I think part of the reason the Glenn character works is that he's largely like invisible, and when he's there, you're just like, oh, dude, you're the worst.
Yeah. And it's like very like grounded, which I don't know if Jim Carrey necessarily would
Yeah.
be. Although I did just watch The Bad Batch the other day, and he is in that like almost completely unrecognizable, because he
I don't know
plays
what that
this.
is.
It's Anna Lily Amanpour. She made that Iranian vampire movie.
Yeah. Oh, I know what it's
His
called.
name I can't remember,
I
but
don't either.
it's this movie about like a girl in this dystopian post United States. I don't know. She gets like cast out into the desert, and all of the bad people in society, the Bad Batch, have been cast out into the desert. So they're all like fending for themselves. And there are some societies that have popped up, and she gets like captured by cannibals, and they amputate a few of her limbs, which was a interesting plot point. But then she like escapes and then winds up in this other place where Keanu Reeves is this like charismatic cult leader, and I want a whole movie about that. But yeah, and then Jim Carrey is just living by himself in the desert and like doesn't speak, which I think was why I didn't recognize him, because like you don't hear his voice, but he's that's interesting. It was a good movie. I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, we established that he's a good actor, so maybe he could have turned it off for this.
But the IMDb trivia point about that was that if Carrey had accepted the role, this would be the only time he and Adam Sandler would co-star in a film together. But like, it's a weird non-trivia.
Yeah, I mean, like,
they just have never been in a movie together.
Together.
Yeah. But anyway, okay, now we can talk about Punch Drunk Love, which came out in, what did I say, 2002?
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Paul Thomas Anderson,
who I realized... The first movie he made after Magnolia.
Yes, and before There Will Be Blood. And I realized while watching this that maybe I hate Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, you know, I love Magnolia, and I actually do like There Will Be Blood. But aside from that, not so much.
I don't know. I was trying to figure out why, and there's a few reasons. One, I have listened to far too much Fiona Apple music over the course of my life to not be at least somewhat suspicious of him. They dated for a while. Apparently their breakup wasn't great. Maybe some of the songs are about him.
Yeah, but he's married to Maya Rudolph, who is a goddess, so...
Yeah. Anyway, the men that he chooses to make movies about, I think says a lot about him. And I find that questionable, because they're all horrible. They're all horrible men. And I forget what the third thing was. But those combine enough to make me, like... I guess suspicious is a good word. Not necessarily that I hate him, but I am mm-hmm. suspicious of him. Although I did just watch the Phantom Thread. I liked that a lot, but the guy that's in that is a real dick too. So, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I feel like there's this thing that exists where, like, in order for something to be, like, art, it has to be dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he very much subscribes to that.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's necessarily true, but...
There was something else, and it just came back to my brain for, like, a flash of a moment and then disappeared again. And that's really frustrating. Here it is.
Okay.
So, we talked a lot about Sofia Coppola, and a frequent critique of her work being that she's kind of keeps making the same movie over and over again. They're about these, like, weird, lonely women, and so maybe she's just making these frivolous biographical, like, autobiographical movies. Like, secretly all of these movies are actually about her. And then I was thinking about Paul Thomas Anderson, and I'm like, maybe the same thing is true, and what she gets criticized for, he gets celebrated for. A hypothesis.
Could be true.
It could be true. Who knows?
Well, so I'm going to say the plot of Punch Drunk Love, because we didn't yet.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Sandler plays... now I definitely don't know anybody's name.
Plays
a guy who is very socially weird, awkward, doesn't have friends, doesn't really date. He sells novelty plungers?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I guess it's his company?
Yeah, him and Luis Guzman sell novelty plungers at this company. And he has seven sisters who are really mean to him.
Yeah, they're fucking terrible.
They're really mean to him. Like, instantly. They're nasty to him in this movie. And one
of
them...
But Marilyn Reichkopf is one of them.
Oh, yeah, she is. And she tries or wants to set him up with a woman that she works with, which he's really stressed out by. But eventually she does, and they instantly fall in love. And then there's two other parts of the plot. This movie has three like plot points, and like that's it. That's the whole movie. And they all like intersect together. So there's that. He's like dating this woman. And then also, I'm not going to explain this well, he's buying a lot of pudding.
Which is, we have been haunted by pudding cups. I mean, this is like the third episode in a row that we're talking about pudding cups.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really pudding month.
Forget Adam Sandler.
Oh, man, I want to make pudding from a box now that we're talking about it again. So he's buying a lot of pudding because he has found a loophole, or what he believes to be a loophole in a contest. I can't remember the brand of food. Can you?
Healthy Choice.
Healthy Choice. Is like running a contest where if you like buy a certain number of products, you get you get airline miles with American Airlines. They work a lot of products into this movie secretly. Yeah. There's a reference to another product also. But anyway, so he's buying a lot of pudding and people keep asking him about it. And then the third part is that before he meets this woman, he calls a phone sex line, and they...
Because he really needs a therapist, but doesn't know how to get to one.
Right.
He doesn't even call for sex. He's just like, I need somebody to talk to.
Yeah. That's my main complaint about the movie, is that what he actually needs besides any of this is a therapist, and he doesn't get one and whatever. But I want to talk about that more in a second. But so he calls a phone sex line voiced by Karen Kilgariff.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that that's her. And they, get his credit card and, like, social security number and, like, address and start, like, trying to steal his money. And they start, like, coming after him physically. And so then eventually he has to, like, explain this to this woman because they're in this car accident.
Also, at the beginning of the movie, he finds a vintage harmonium on the street and then takes it. And then there's no payoff there. It's just in the movie.
But do you know what? John Bryan did the score largely on a harmonium, which I didn't know what that was until today.
Oh, yeah. He uses those kinds of keyboards in most of his, like,
scores. No, but I think this is the first time that he worked with one on such a wide scale. I might be making that up, but maybe I also read that and it stuck in my brain. That was the only thing. I'm glad I read that before I watched it, because otherwise, yeah, that dumb thing doesn't pay off at all. It falls out of a car. Right? Like, he sees a car accident.
I have no fucking idea what happens in that opening scene, because, yeah, it seems like a car flips over, but then also there's a car driving. Because it seems like a car is driving by and they just throw it out.
Yeah, but the car also flips over.
Is that the same car?
I don't know.
There you go. That's all you really need to know about the movie.
Oh, here's the other thing you need to know, because everyone talks about it all the time, is he started wearing a suit, and he wears the same suit every day.
Mm-hmm. And it is a non-standard blue.
Nice suit. I think he looks nice.
Yeah, it's a nice blue
color. His sisters keep, like, ragging on him about it.
And the people he works with. Although Luis Guzman starts dressing up, too, I noticed. That made me laugh. I love him. He's not in this movie enough.
Here's where I was like, oh my god, I can't take this movie. But there's a lot here. Like, I don't want to call it a bad movie.
Listen,
it's just not fun to watch.
Many, like, top tier directors consider this one of their favorite films. People love this movie.
But
I'm starting to think maybe there is no reason to.
Here's where I was like, this is so hard to watch, is when he's standing in his office, which is like, has a door, but it's glass, so you can see what's happening on the outside, and his sister has just come in with this woman who's trying to date him, and she's like standing in his office, and his phone is ringing, and the phone sex people are calling him to try to threaten him, and at the same time, like, a bunch of shit happens outside the window right behind him. Do you know what part I'm talking about?
Yeah. Somebody, drives a forklift into something.
Yeah, and everything falls down, and he, like, tries really hard not to react at all to it because there's so many other things happening. Oh, God.
So here's
stressful.
The thing. I think this character definitely exhibits some characteristics of a person who might be on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. So it's not It's not so much that he's like trying not to react. I think he like has a hard time processing what's going on and also has a hard time with like emotional regulation, which is why like sometimes he doesn't react at all and then other times he breaks a glass door. You know what I mean?
Okay, so here's let's that brings us to my main problem with this movie, which is just like a thing that happens in movies a lot, which is that people who need therapists and medication go find a lot of other things and they say that that solved their problems, but it didn't. And
But
I just can't
we don't
stand
get to
it.
see what happens after the credits
No,
roll.
but I just hate that like this movie. These aren't the right words for this, but like this movie has a happy ending, right? Like,
More like as happy as this movie is gonna get, yeah.
yeah, like he admits the truth, he gets together with the woman, he gets his airline miles. But
Which
like that's
was an actual scam that a guy, or not a scam, he like figured out that this brand was doing this marketing tactic, figured out that there was this loophole where the monetary value of the reward so greatly outweighed the monetary value of the food that he did that. And this is why brands don't really do that anymore. So that part of it was actually a true story. Or based on a true story. Sorry, I derailed
No,
you. What were
no, no,
you
no.
talking
I think
about?
that's interesting, and it's like it's such a funny detail that like, of course that was real. Of course that's real. Yeah, I just don't like when people in movies are like, "Cool, we're in love. It solved all of our problems." Instead of being like, "Actually, I don't think we should date. I think you need a therapist first. This isn't gonna work." You know? It's just like it happens so much. It makes me crazy.
And we also, I mean, I think the thing we're supposed to conclude is like they're both kooky and weird, and
Yeah,
that's why
obviously
they're
she
into
is
each other.
also.
But like we don't get enough of her, I don't think. Like
No, we don't really
apparently
know her.
she is following him in the grocery store before we even meet her, but she's like, I've read this after the fact. I didn't notice her there, but there's a person in red who's like following him in the grocery store when he's trying to figure out what the lowest priced item that he can buy to maximize.
Oh, and that's when he finds the pudding.
Yeah, but apparently she's like following him the whole time.
Well, that would go with her story.
I don't know. I would have liked it if she was in this more, or like was an active participant in this story more instead of just like things happening to her. But I guess this whole movie is just things happening to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe that's what's so painful about it to watch. It's like it's just watching people not be able to take any kind of control over anything that's happening to them.
Which is how most people function in the world. I mean, that's, I don't know, like maybe this is just too much like real life and that's why I don't like it.
Well, I wouldn't go maybe that far, but yeah, like it's too. If these were real people, and I'm sure real people like this do exist, it's too upsetting to think that real people like this exist. Like I just, it's just, yeah, I don't like it.
Well, back to the score. Sean Bryan actually composed music for the film while filming was taking place, which is like not something that usually happens. So he was actually like on set experimenting with tones and sounds, making particular note of what Paul Thomas Anderson was responding to. And so his score would then be played on set, like helping to influence the tone of the film. But also, he and Marilyn Reichkob like were dating for a long time and broke up right before this movie started.
Oh
So
no.
he sometimes had to spend like 8 hours a day playing music while watching her.
That's stressful. I think this character, like the character that Adam Sandler plays in this, is like if you took like all of his other characters, not all of them, but you know, like the Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore types, and took away all of their power and courage and privilege, you're left with this person. He's like, he has a lot in common with those characters, he just doesn't have any of the privilege or, like, brashness of them.
Or confidence.
Yeah. Because then my next question is, like, is Adam Sandler a good actor? Or is he just always doing the same thing?
I think The Wedding Singer proves that he has, like, pretty tremendous range. I think he really does have, like, incredible range because of just what he does in The Wedding Singer alone. But also I watched something that just came out, like, a couple years ago called The Meyerowitz Stories.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that one.
Yeah. He plays one of three children to an aging narcissistic artist played by Dustin Hoffman. And it's a Noah Baumbach movie, so of course it's, like, very emo. But he is very, is like, has a pretty, he has a few moments of, like, freaking out and yelling in that one, but otherwise is pretty subdued in that, and I think shows, like, it seems like this, I don't know where I'm going with that. That was a good movie, though. You should see it.
Your point is he can act.
Yeah, my point is he can act, and that movie was like an emotional bazooka went right through me, which I was not expecting.
I also watched him on SNL.
Yeah, how was that?
Fine. I mean, you know, fine. I think the most interesting, well, two interesting parts. His opening monologue was him singing a song about how he got fired from Saturday Night Live, which I didn't remember. And that's why he's never hosted it before until now. Oh, because he's a huge star, and this is the first time he's hosted it since he was on it.
Yeah,
which
that
was
hadn't
like
occurred
in 1995 or something.
Yeah. Did he get fired for something in particular?
No, he's never said, like, no one's ever given a reason, but him and Chris Farley both got fired that same summer.
That's surprising. I thought that they were, like, huge draws.
I mean, like, yes and no, like, it kind of, like right after that on SNL is when, like, Will Ferrell and, like, Harry O'Terry and, like, that whole new round of comedians that were, like, really, really popular came in. Yeah. So it's like they kind of got rid of, like, and they got rid of, I think Chris Rock left at that time too. They kind of just, like, did a big shuffle around that time. You know, and then everyone who got fired then just went on to become, like, a giant movie star. Like, but so then at the end of the episode, he sang a song about Chris Farley. And it was just, like, bawling. They were friends, and it was very sweet and really sad. And also really strange to see these photos of Chris Farley next to Adam Sandler now, and it's like, holy shit, like, they were young.
Yeah.
Chris Farley was young, and to see how now that Adam Sandler has aged, and it's like, I just never thought about it before.
Yeah.
It was really sweet.
So sad. Yeah.
He did a very, you know how they kind of, like, at the end of the show, they just put the weird sketches? He did one of those with Kristen Wiig was there, and Kate McKinnon. That was, like, kind of weird and gross in a fun way. He did an Opera Man on Weekend Update.
Interesting.
But besides that, like, nothing. Oh, I sent you a photo of the one. They did one that was, like, a Sandler family reunion.
Huh.
And it was just, like, all of his family members going, like, hey, like, you made your characters after us. And it's just, like, they're all of his characters. That's why Leslie Jones was dressed up like Chubbs.
Gotcha. That's really funny.
Yeah, that one was cute. But, like, pretty forgettable besides that.
Yeah.
He seems, I don't know, he strikes me as someone who would be, like, legitimately a really nice person in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch him on SNL, he looks, like, tired or, like, bored and also, like, genuinely, like, has a lot of genuine gratitude at the same time.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't know.
That's interesting. I mean, I don't know how you wouldn't be tired by the time you actually, like, get to the actual live show. The whole thing sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
I was just looking back at some of the trivia notes that I had pulled for Punch Drunk Love. At 95 minutes, it is the shortest film that Paul Thomas Anderson has written and directed, which is funny because at, like, the halfway point, I got up to go to the bathroom. I was like, oh, God, how much longer? And saw that I was at the halfway point and felt very relieved. But then also that I was like, this is only an hour and a half? My God. Because when I went to see There Will Be Blood in the movie theater with the person that I was dating at the time, they turned to me at the halfway point and was like, who? And they had seen the movie like several times already, turned to me at the halfway point and were like, how do you like it? And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's great. Whatever. And they were like, yeah, this is the halfway point. And I was like, no, because that movie is so long. And I thought it was almost over. So that happens to me a lot when I'm watching Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
Did you ever hear Paul F. Tompkins tell the story about doing the table read for Magnolia?
No.
He was meant to be in that. I think maybe he was in it, but they cut him out. It was, like, you know, a really small part, which is why he's in There Will Be Blood. Because okay. Paul Thomas Anderson was like, oh, sorry, I cut you out of that one. Do you want to be in the other one? So he tells this whole story about, like, he gets this giant script and then, like, doesn't really prepare, like, at all. And he's, like, doesn't know what parts he's reading. And then he's sitting at a table next to Tom Cruise. Like, it's fun.
That's wild.
It's on one of his comedy albums.
Yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson refers to this film as an art house Adam Sandler film, so maybe that's why it feels like he's just doing
the same but different.
The same thing. It's just arty. Paul Thomas Anderson actually now, like, does his own cinematography. Like, he works with, like, a lighting consultant, I think, but he no longer uses a director of photography, but the person that was the director of photography on this, Robert L. Swit, used a special kind of film stock that allowed him to shoot mostly in underexposed light, which is why this movie looks so, like, dark and weird and has so
really
many
dark,
like, weird lens flares and stuff. Yeah,
I watched it. I have a projector, but I don't have blackout curtains, so I watched it with my projector, but, like, when those dark scenes happen, I couldn't see it.
Mm-mm.
Why did they do those, like, colors?
Oh, those are just, like, interstitial video art by some other artist. Why? I don't know why they use that.
Sometimes it made sense, like, sometimes it was, like, they would,
like,
play
sensual.
It.
Yeah, like, had, like, a sensual kind of feeling to it, and then other times it was just like, we didn't know how to transition scenes.
Yeah. Oh, you know what we didn't talk about is that Philip Seymour Hoffman is in this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very good in it.
Yeah. He's fine. I don't know. I hate his character. I was just like, I don't want to be here. I don't like this.
He was the only one who played a character that I didn't. That didn't make me want to crawl out of my skin, though.
Oh, interesting. Because I also feel skin crawly. Mm-hmm. But that character was actually based on, like, a real mattress salesman. And apparently they shot, like, a whole commercial for his mattress sales business that didn't wind up in the final cut, but apparently is on the special features. This is the only Adam Sandler film released as part of the Criterion Collection, by the way.
That checks out.
Yeah.
Yo, side note, I have the Criterion channel right now. Mm-hmm. Because you can do a free trial, And I tried to watch Eraserhead the other night with my projector, and it wouldn't let me.
Why?
It can detect if you're watching on a device that isn't. It's like an anti-piracy thing.
Oh, where, yeah.
Like, it just won't work with some devices, so I can't project Criterion Channel movies, and it sucks.
That really does suck. Imagine if it wasn't anti-piracy and they were just like, no, we just don't think that the resolution's going to be good enough.
Oh my god, they would be very disappointed in it. So that was disappointing to find out.
Yeah, I have a huge Eraserhead box set that I, like, inherited from somebody who was getting rid of a lot of their physical media, and I've never opened it, because I'm terrified of that movie. I saw it once in art school and was like, nope.
Yeah, it's, like, really, like, talk about, like,
crawling out of your skin. Yeah. I learned after the fact that he made that movie about living in Philadelphia, like, about how he felt when he was living there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yes. Yeah, I also live there, and it's terrible.
Yeah, he doesn't really talk about, like, why he does what he does, but, like, I think that's one that everyone can agree on, is, like, that movie was largely influenced by Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And also by him, he was about to become a father.
Mm-hmm. Which is very, very evident in that story.
I read, I read his book, Catching the Big Fish, which is, like, barely a book. Like, there's literally a chapter that's one sentence long.
Of course there is.
Yeah, because it's David Lynch. But, like, he talked about making Eraserhead in it, and he had no money, no anything, and, like, he would just be like, you know, I would go work and make as much money as I could, and then we would, like, just scrounge together whatever we could and shoot, like, if one scene, one shot, like, he would just, like, do whatever he had to. It took them, like, years to make it, but it was just, it was nice to hear him talk about, like, the determination that it took, and he just, like, held on to that dream and did it, and he did it.
Yeah, that's really crazy. I read that Paul Thomas Anderson went to NYU for, like, 2 days, and he was in a film class, and one of the professors were like, if you're here because you want to make a movie like Terminator 2, then you could just leave right now. So he did. Which is interesting because none of his movies are like Terminator 2. But I agree with him. I think that Terminator 2 is an incredible work of art. Well, I don't know if he actually believes that. I do. But also that, like, in another class, he turned in a paper that was just, like, I don't know, maybe a paper or a script or whatever, that an assignment that was just a plagiarism of something that David Mamet had written, just to, like, see if they would notice, and he got a C on it. So he was like, all right, I clearly don't need these chuckleheads. And so it was early enough in the semester that he was able to get the money back, and then he, like, went and made his first movie instead, which I think is cool. And probably smart. And also seems to have worked out well for him.
Yeah, I think he's doing okay.
Yeah.
Is that it for Adam Sandler? Is it the time where we say the other things that we watched?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because after I watched The Wedding Singer last night, I watched the HBO documentary about, you know, that guy who touched all the little girls.
Oh.
Larry Nassar.
Yeah, the gymnastics guy.
Oh my god,
why
couldn't I remember that? That's bad.
No. He doesn't deserve to be remembered by name.
At the Heart of Gold, it's called. And it was made by David Carr's daughter.
Oh,
also,
yeah.
Made something else that I was like, oh, yeah. That, oh, she made the one, Mommy, Dead and Dearest. She made that, too.
Oh, yeah. She was just on Fresh Air the other day. I heard the interview with her.
So if you don't know anything about what happened in USA Gymnastics in the last couple of years.
Bless your heart.
No, it don't is bless your heart. Grim. Go Google it right now. It's really important.
Yeah, you should know, but it's awful.
Basically, gymnastics became a sport where little girls didn't... It was like a perfect storm of little girls having a dream, not having a voice, not being taken care of. And this man, who was the USA Gymnastics Olympic doctor, was let to be alone with them and do medical treatments on them where he was molesting,
like, alleged medical treatments that are not medical treatments.
Yeah. Hundreds of girls, and not that's even just women. The ones they we were know all about. Underage. I mean, mm-hmm. not all of them. A lot of them were underage mm-hmm. for years, for like at least 20 years. And he is also working for Michigan State University mm-hmm. In the athletic programs there.
And there were many complaints about him mm-hmm. over the years.
And they just like 100% turned a blind eye to it.
Well, they conducted a couple of investigations, I think, and then they were like, bullshit. Well, he says it's medical, so...
The documentary goes into some of the details of that and, like, how that happened. And it's, you know, was just basically a bunch of adults not protecting children. They were not mm-hmm. listening to children, and they weren't protecting them. Who knows why? I'm sure there's more than one reason. But it was disgusting and just... Like, everybody needs to see it, because it's, I can't, like, yes, it's something that's close to my heart, because that's my sport, mm-hmm. But even just aside from that, like, just the institutionalized, like, molestation of girls.
Yeah.
Because so many people were compliant with what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And just totally turned a blind eye to it and let it happen.
And this is one example of one person in one sport. And it's something that, like, we like to think doesn't happen, and when, like, would never happen to our kids or would never happen to ourselves or, like, whatever. But, like, he's one person in gymnastics, and there have been many people in gymnastics that we know of, you know, and the same is true in so many other sports, and not just in sports, in the arts, in like any situations that set up these kind of like perfect storm circumstances to just facilitate abuse. I mean, look at the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this shit does happen, so, and like people need to stop pretending it doesn't.
Like, I was thinking of, this, like, made me think about something that I just never really thought about before, which is that basically, like, USA Gymnastics uses these women to make a shit ton of money every 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because mm-hmm. they're not even, like, most of them are girls. They're not yeah. even women. They are underage girls. And, like, besides the, like, sexual abuse, like, they are destroying their bodies to mm-hmm. do this. And I don't think people really think about that.
I think they're starting to more, like, after yes. learning about, like, what concussions might so do there, to brains yeah, and stuff like that.
There's a movement in gymnastics now that is small but definitely growing to really change the way gymnasts train. And that's great. It's really mm-hmm. different from... like how it was when I grew up, but like, yeah, just like the exploitation of these women and their bodies for mm-hmm. money every 4 years, because people love watching gymnastics at the Olympics, and because we win, we're yeah. best in the world. Nobody's gonna beat us. Like, no one else is even close anymore.
Well, that was true, but there's a whole pipeline that kind of got like exploded with all of this, didn't it? Like, it's going to, like, take a while to kind of, like, rebuild.
Yes and no. Like, USA Gymnastics is a shit show. But as far as, like, the gymnasts that are competing for us, like, yes, like, there was a shakeup for them. But, like, it hasn't affected the quality of their gymnastics. It hasn't affected, like, Simone Biles is still here. She's going to win stuff. Like the girls and women who are still... doing this, who are still competing at a really, really high level, like, they are doing it because they love the sport, like, it's not going to be that easy. You can't get rid of them, you know? Like, think about, like, if you think about what it takes to make a gymnast, it's like, those, even the little girls are so strong mentally, because you can't be anything else to do it. You just can't be. And so, yeah, I mean, if you look at who's still competing and who's still winning, like, it's still us.
Which is so wild that the team has been that good when this was literally happening at the Olympics. Like, Larry Nassar was abusing... It literally was
happening at the Olympics.
Yeah. Allie Raisman and Gabby Douglas. And, like, they were experiencing this abuse literally at the Olympics. And then they won a fucking gold medal. Like, that is...
But it's fucked up. But, like, that's, like, that they were able to do that, that's the kind of brain that you have to be that high level an athlete, to be that high level a gymnast.
To be able to compartmentalize that.
Of being able to, like, switch feelings on and off and, like, switch fears on and off.
Yeah.
Like, I hate that that's true, but it's, like, you know.
Well, I was, like, really overcome, like, with emotion watching, like, the women give their victim impact statements after his trial. Especially for the ones that have had media training, like Allie Raisman. I was like, oh, holy shit. She's like a robot that they have developed and trained to destroy them, kind of. Like, the media training that she's had, like, all of the mental stuff that goes along with being a gymnast, of, like, facing your fears and, like, you know, staying the course and, like, you know, working towards a goal, like, all of that, like, created these, like, monsters that are here to take down USA Gymnastics. And I think that's really rad.
And the woman who started it all, whose name I can never remember.
No, Rachel. Me neither. I feel so bad.
Her name, I always want to call her Rachel Dolezal, who is the woman who pretended she was black.
Yeah,
no,
that it's person.
Not her. But her name is also Rachel, and her last name starts with a D, and it's a complicated last name, so I can never remember it, and I always feel so bad. She's incredible. She, like, when this started to happen to her, when she was younger, she started
Rachel Den Hollander.
Thank you. See, last name no one's ever heard before. She started to document it.
Because she knew something was wrong.
Yeah, so when she, like, this didn't even start because of Larry Nassar. It started because the Indianapolis Star newspaper ran a different article about, like, another kind of sex abuse in gymnastics. And she called them, and she was like, hey, this happened to me. I want to call some people out. And she had written things down. Like, she had her shit straight. Like, she's really incredible.
Yeah,
not that you're not incredible if you, like, didn't have your shit straight, but just, like, that she did it really systematically.
I'm so impressed. And then she fucking went to law school also.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. All of those women, whether they came forward or not, are amazing. And I'm so grateful that they thought about it before. Yeah.
In the 60s, gymnastics was a women's sport, not a little girl's sport. And the Carolis are the ones who changed that.
They were Romanian.
They were Romanian, but then they came here. And they were the biggest things. They were the biggest things in USA Gymnastics for 30 years.
Yeah, and they facilitated the abuse.
Yeah, like, if you wanted to go to the Olympics, that's who you went and trained with. And actually, I'm, like, halfway through Dominique Moschiano's book now, which is really interesting because she trained with them and will openly speak out against them.
I read, like, a really long investigative piece about them, like, last year or the year before, that was really interesting. And, like, just all of the shit that they've facilitated and covered up over the years is pretty disgusting.
Yeah, so I never thought about that part before, where it's like, oh, yeah, it wasn't always little girls. Because the men, like, if you look at men's gymnastics, those are all, like, men. They're not underage. They're not boys.
I mean, and it's true of figure skating too, mm-hmm. and it's these sports that, like, for women to get the advantage because of the way that, like, it's part of how they've set up scoring now. It's part of, like, you know, advantages and disadvantages that men and women have, like, make the sports different for the two genders. And so for women, it's about being tiny and being fast and being able to fly as far as you can, basically. And that's true of figure skating also. And so now it's like
I have one argument against that for female gymnasts.
What is that?
If you watch, like, the Chinese gymnasts who are particularly small because they cheat and lie about their age, they cannot push the vaulting board, like the springboard. Mm. They can't push it hard enough to vault as well as Simone Biles does because they're too small.
Yeah, and I mean, Simone Biles, like, she's short, but she's like, built dense. As hell, you know? So, like she's a special case and clearly has some genetic advantages.
She really does. Look how long her arms are.
Yeah. But, like, for the most part, generally speaking, like, the tinier you are and the less you weigh, the higher you'll fly. And so, like, in figure skating, like, the top three spots are always going to these, like, 13-year-old Russian girls who can do a, you know, quad jumps and quintuple jumps and whatever. And, like, men peak way later and are able to do those kinds of jumps way later after they put on a bunch of muscle, you know? So, like, men have such longer careers than women are.
That should be true for women also, like, mm-hmm. in some ways, yes, and in some ways no, because women's bodies are different than men's bodies because of boobs and hips.
And also, women experience a, like, exponentially higher injury rate. We don't know why, because no one studied it, but what research does exist indicates that it might be hormonal, But again, we don't know because nobody studied it. But, like,
if you look at why we're better than the Russians, it's because we can tumble and vault, and the Russians can't because they're all skinny and mm-hmm. small, and you just can't get that the kind of power that you now need for the difficulty in gymnastics. You can't get that kind of power if you're tiny.
Yeah.
And you can see that's why we win now and they don't.
Interesting.
So I don't know what that says about how it should be or how it'll change, but.
Did you watch anything else that was of note?
No, I don't think so.
On a very, 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 very different note, I watched Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
That's the second one?
Yeah. It's so good. Those movies are absolutely bonkers. I don't understand how or why they exist, but I am so glad that they do. I just was, like, weeping and laughing and crying the whole time. It was great. Cher's in it. She looks amazing. There's so much good dancing. There's, like, an armada of dancing people. Like, a literal armada. Several boats full of dancing people who are dancing. I think they're dancing to probably Dancing Queen, maybe SOS. Who cares? It's a great ABBA song. They, like, show up to the party all dancing. It's great. Loved it so much.
Do you think those movies are just, like, a fun throwback to, like, when movies were musicals, when they didn't know what movies were going to be yet?
Maybe.
I've never seen them, but that's, like, my fun take on it.
I mean, all movies that are musicals are throwbacks to movies
that were musicals before. No, because there aren't that many movies that are musicals anymore, like, besides kids' movies, and that's not the same.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think people will always continue to try to make musicals, and some will fail and some will succeed, and I think that these are just insane enough to really, really, really work. And it also helps that they're songs that are incredible, and they're also songs that have like embedded themselves in our consciousness already. So it's like, oh, they're singing the song I know. You know? Like, in the second one, Cher sings the song Fernando, which is an ABBA song that I love so much because as a little kid I just found it hilarious. I don't know why, just the way they say Fernando. And when she started singing that, I just burst into tears. I was crying so hard. Just, they're wonderful. They're like, just like junk. Like, I want to say junk food, but that's the wrong word for it because it's like junk food that's good for you know? Just totally good for your heart and your soul and your brain because you don't have to think that hard. This one features like flashbacks to when the characters were younger in the 70s. And the woman that plays the Meryl Streep character, I don't know what her name is, hang on, because she's an amazing movie star, and I can't wait to see her do other things. Lily James. I think she might be British, but I look forward to seeing more stuff from her because she's like, I think, a Julia Roberts level movie star. I
I feel like
watched.
Joey would know who she is and have like 800 things to say about her,
Yeah,
but maybe I
probably.
made that up.
Yeah, maybe. The Wicker
Oh no,
Man.
he would because she was in Baby Driver.
Oh, okay. There you go. I watched The Wicker Man, the one with Nicolas Cage, which is
Oh, I've been meaning
wonderful.
to watch that for years.
I really enjoy it. I like it a lot, except he punches a bunch of women in the face.
Why?
Other than that, it's great. He thinks that his child is in danger. So I don't know. Anyway, I watched Half Baked. I rewatched Half Baked, which
Is it
was
good?
not really.
I
No,
wouldn't
not
think
really,
so.
unfortunately. Like, there were still some jokes that I laughed really hard at. I think visually it's great. Definitely a lot of surrealism in that, but not too good.
Related, have you watched or listened to Neil Brennan's Three Mics?
I have not.
Oh, you should.
That's the one where he has three microphones, right?
Yes. He talks a little bit about like his relationship with Dave Chappelle and like having written that movie and just stuff. It's interesting. He talks a lot about mental illness and he's also very funny.
Okay, I might check it out. Something that wasn't very funny that I watched was a romantic comedy called Man Up from 2015, starring Lake Bell, who I love
I love
so
her too, but
much.
she's not in anything good.
I know, it's
It's a
so
problem.
bad.
I
Except
know.
for In a World. I mean, but that was her movie that she like
Yeah,
wrote and directed.
but also like it was okay. It
Oh, I
wasn't,
like that a
I don't
lot.
know. Okay.
I think she's great in it. It's like her and Simon Pegg, and Simon Pegg is the manic pixie dream girl, and it just did not work for me at all. I also saw the new Suspiria, which was pretty cool on its own. Not the remake that I wanted to see, but like, I'll take it. There's more dancing in that in this one, so
I
that
like
was
that.
cool. It's also an hour longer than the original.
I don't need that.
Yeah, there's also a lot of nonsensical stuff happening in it that doesn't really ever add up or make sense, but it's fine. And I also finally saw Book Club, that movie with Jane Fonda and all the other ladies whose names I like can't remember at the
Yeah, I know
moment.
what you're talking
Oh,
about.
Diane Keaton and Candice Bergen and Mary Steenburgen, and they're a book club who have been meeting for the last like 40 years, and they started with Erica Jong's Fear of Flying, which was like an iconic feminist text about sex and sexuality.
I used to teach
And
gymnastics to her granddaughter.
oh, cool. And now it's, present day, they're all much older in their 70s and 80s. And now they're reading 50 Shades of Grey, which I was kind of like, oh God, of all the books, why did they have to read that one? But I thought it was interesting that they like connected that with Fear of Flying, although they could have done more connecting, certainly. Also Alicia Silverstone is in it. She plays one of Diane Keaton's daughters. All of the women in this movie deserve so much better. It's not that great, but I also like laughed and cried a lot. So it was fine. It was enjoyable. I feel like it's a good movie to watch on a plane. I also watched all of Tuca and Birdie on Netflix, the new cartoon.
You told me to watch that one.
Straight through already 1.5 times. I really love it. It's wonderful. It's so weird. And also, like, the cartoon I've been waiting for my whole life.
Much of my time has been taken up by trying to make my way through Comedy Bang Bang's 10-hour episode.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, every minute of it so far is worth it.
Yeah.
It's just very long.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to add?
No. Nope.
Cool. Then that does it for our episode of Wistful Thinking. We haven't chosen a theme for next month yet. Mm-mm. So that'll be a surprise. But you can go back and listen to our other Adam Sandler episode about Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison, or any of our other episodes about all sorts of stuff, or our episodes of our spinoff podcast, What Am I Chewing? We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.